is the Buddhist view of mind? Is it something separate from the body, or does it manifest itself through the body?
It's not this body. Not this body. So it wouldn't be the case that for Western sort of the people I worked with in neuroscience, the mind is the brain, right? I mean, for most of them, the mind is the brain.
It's a brain function. It's a process of the brain.
That's
the
brain. Yeah, well, but then there are different ways of saying it's the brain, right? So there are many ways to think about it being the brain. And if you're a Nobel laureate, then you decide that there's two things, right? I think that if you get a Nobel Prize in science, you end up being a dualist. And if you don't get a Nobel Prize, you're a materialist. I think that's how it goes. I haven't quite figured it out yet, but people I worked with, all the Nobel laureates were dualists, and all the non-Nobel laureates were materialists. So I worked with people people who had worked in genetics and things and got Nobel Prizes, and they were all dualists, but the other people were materialists. So in science, most people in science tend to be materialists, but their materialism takes different forms. The mind is the brain the brain in several ways. It can be literally the cells and what's going on in there. Some people believe that. Some people believe that it's a function. So it's some kind of they believe that in a lot of ways. I don't know if I should go into all of this, but they believe it in a lot of different ways, that it's a function. Some people believe that it's a higher order, the mind is some kind of higher order property of the brain. So, like, there are physical properties and there are non-physical properties to the brain, right? And the non-physical properties are the mental properties, and the physical properties are that, you know, it's wet and squishy, it's got neurons and, you know, that kind of thing.
Is that what you mean by emergent property?
Yeah, emergent property, yeah. But they have a lot of trouble with emergent property. Do people know what emergent properties are? You know when you have a bunch of hydrogen and oxygen molecules and you put them in a jar together? Well, this is not right, but if you... hydrogen, you've got a bunch of molecules and you put them, these two hydrogen and oxygen together, you end up with water, right? If it gets bonded in the right way, right? Well, the molecules themselves aren't wet. An atom isn't wet. But water is wet. So at the level of the sort of the system, there is this emergent property, which is wetness, whereas the parts of the system don't have that property of wetness. So the argument about the brain is that the brain is the same way. At the level of the brain, there are all these neurons and everything, you know, these little cells, and they all do all these things. And they're not mental. I mean, they don't have anything mental about them. But when you put them all together, somehow some, like wetness, comes out of a bunch of atoms when you put them together. Mind comes out of a bunch of neurons when you put them together, okay? There's really... It sounds great. I mean, on the face of it, it sounds all right, you know, right? I mean, you know, wet... Wetness is not in the parts. It's not. And then mind, it's not. I mean, I guarantee you, look in the brain, you will never find a mind. You will never be able to pull out mind in any form or shape. Or I don't even know what it would look like, but it's not there.
But is that not like saying, if I give you a CD and I say, well, where is the 1812 Overture, and you look at it, you wouldn't see it. But when you play it, the version properly of that is this music, which means a lot to you.
Yeah, yeah, it's the same. But to look at the two cases here. The main problem with this, and this is always my objection to it, is in the case of the water and the molecules, the emergent property and the parts are physical, and the emergent property is a physical property. In the case of the CD, the CD itself is a physical thing, and the emergent thing is a physical thing.
No, the music's in your mind.
Oh, well, if it's just the noise, then it's a physical thing. But in the case of the brain and the mind, we have a physical system being claimed to have an emergent property that's non-physical. Mind is not physical. So they want to draw on that parallel of emergent property in physics or in physical science, but they want to apply it to something to which is a whole different category. So you have two different categories, physical and non-physical. And there's no other example of anything like this. There's no other argument for any... Nobody wants to make this argument for anything else.
What's like life? Is that not an emergent property?
No. Not in Buddhism, it's not. It's not even in science. They don't know what life is. They don't know what mind is either.
But they would suggest life is an emergent property of matter.
They don't know.
Well, no, they would say. Well, sorry to.
You think?
Well,
say,
I mean, they would say we were just molecules all stuck together, and either that somehow because of the structure of emergent life.
Yeah, right. Somehow or another. That's not a very scientific statement. So, I mean, usually what they do is they don't touch it. And they just, I mean, usually what they do is, well, we'll leave that for a later date, or maybe philosophers will worry about it, because it doesn't sound very scientific to say somehow or another, you know? I mean, you know,
well, sorry, I was suggesting more of a philosophical argument than scientific argument.
Yeah, but even philosophers don't want to touch it, you know? We have to touch it because it's our field, and then they laugh at us, you know, right? And then they say, ha ha, see, we don't do philosophy. But they don't want to talk about it. So mind is a big, it's a real big problem for Western thinking. And in Buddhism, they thought a great, great, great deal about mind. And I think probably when he's talking about third turning of the wheel, that's where probably we'll talk more about it. And then he'll talk about what mind is in Buddhism. But in the West, we certainly have no, as far as I can understand, no really coherent account of what the nature of mind is. We have some accounts of the features of mental phenomena, that, for instance, psychology is about some features of mental phenomena. We have a general idea about the nature of the structure of conscious mental state, which is this intentionality, which is a subject having an object. We have that understanding in the West. We have some understanding about how mental states hang together at that level of conscious act. But we have no real coherent, flat-out statement about what mind is. And if you try to make one, you meet with great, enormous skepticism. It's very difficult to make a flat-out statement about it. Mostly, I had to review a book, and it was a book on the nature, it was called The Nature of Mind and the Brain, by a woman who taught at Cambridge, University of England. And I read the entire 350 pages, and never once in the 350 pages did she define mind. Never once at all, ever. So she said it was a difficult topic. She said there were many different ideas about it. She said it was extremely, very hard to make a precise statement of it, but she never told you what it was. But it was a book on the nature of mind and the brain. And my criticism was you shouldn't title your book that, or you should like maybe just talk about the brain part and forget the rest of the book. Because
philosophers write books on mind as well.
You bet. And they don't know what they're talking about most of them. You'd still make a living doing philosophy and not make sense. It's not required. That's the difference between doing philosophy or being a philosopher. You have a job, it's called being a philosopher, right? I can make a living at it. I don't have to make any sense at all. But if you are a philosopher because your life depends on it, like you have to be in Buddhism, then not making sense is a fatal flaw. This is an extremely fatal flaw. So for us, if we're interested in liberation and omniscience, then we have to be philosophers who can't afford to be inconsistent and ultimately not know what we're talking about or what we're heading for or what is going to be changed or what we're doing the changes to. We have to understand the nature of mind. Why? Because we have to change the nature. We have to do something with this nature of mind. Something's wrong with the nature. That's the fundamental problem, right? That's what Buddha says, something's wrong here. Well, then we can't just sit around and say, well, it's a really difficult topic. You know, and we can't have our geshes and our great teachers just sort of saying, well, you know, in one sentence, using it in four different ways, it's not going to work. We have to be very, very precise because we have to do something about it. So then we aren't earning our living being a philosopher. We're using philosophy to get to our objective, which is a completely different thing. So I never could teach philosophy. When I finally got my degree, I couldn't accept a job teaching philosophy. It depressed me. It really depressed me. So then I went into science. But I had taught philosophy before that. But that was all right, because I was just learning how to argue and stuff. But when I got done, then I had to be around all these guys who just taught philosophy. And then when we all got together, they were all trying to figure out where their, you know, their sailboats and what kind of wine we were going to drink. And then it's just like, I felt really uncomfortable. I didn't know I was going to be a Buddhist, but I, you know, I obviously I was on my way. So anyway, we got to be really precise about mind in this. So then we have to, if it doesn't make sense what they've got to say at the level of searching and real about nature of mind, which is some of these tools that the sort of Nyingman, Kagyu lineage, they have a lot to say about nature of mind, a lot. We have to study it very, very carefully. We have to study about what the other schools say about the nature of mind at different levels, not the ultimate level, but the other levels. We have to see if it hangs together. And it helps us. Each of these levels is not just for an intellectual understanding of mind, it's for so we can work at that level of mind. You know? It's not, we don't learn like Buddhist psychology, sort of the psychological ideas. We don't use those, we don't learn those just so we can get a degree in psychology. We learn them so that we can work with the delusions and the obstructions and all of the things that are there. We learn how to use them as tools. Then we learn the more subtle levels. We have to learn what to do. We have to learn what our problems are and where we have to work at it. And when we learn at the third turning of the wheel, when we're doing tantra and things, we're learning to these very subtle notions of what mind is, so that we can work at the most subtle level, so that we can take our body and our energy and completely pull it in and start working on those levels of mind. And we're not using the other levels anymore, but we can't do that until we can understand what we're going to do and what needs to be changed and what's there and what to expect. And, you know, you can't practice dying every day until you understand what the nature of mind is at the most subtle level, because, you know, it might be aloha when you go through the thing at the end, you don't come back. So, I mean, you need to have a really subtle understanding of what nature of mind is then in order to work there, right? Makes perfect sense. But this stuff is really pragmatic. It's really kind of hands-on stuff. You don't learn it just because, you know, you're going to get a degree in it. You're doing it because you're going to have to work with that. So then you have to know it exhaustively. You have to really have a good grasp about what this subtle Dharmakaya clear light sort of nature of mind is, because you're going to put yourself into that state. You're going to cause it to happen to yourself and then generate this bliss in that state. And it's something incredible is going to happen from that, but you need to be able to know what's happening, what to expect, what to look for, what to avoid and all that. So this isn't like an academic matter anymore. So at one level, it's really important that we learn all this stuff. On another level, you have to remember when you're learning it, you're not just learning it for a course. You're learning it because you have to use it. So it's more a kind of, it isn't such a sort of academic, sort of just purely academic thing. It's an academic thing in the service of liberation and the mission. So it's more of a kind of like, it's more like being an engineer going to school than it is like being a philosopher going to school. The one, you're just learning ideas so that you can tell somebody ideas. The other one, you're learning ideas so hopefully my house doesn't fall down. Right? I mean, hopefully. You know, the bridge won't collapse. So it's not good enough that you just learn those ideas. You need it. You're going to apply it. So this is more like applied, this will be like applied philosophy, applied theory ultimately. But you got to get the theory, otherwise you can't build the bridge either, so it's really demanding. It's really hard work.